from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudet. You're listening to Idaho Matters, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We're going to get you updated on all of the news that made headlines this last week. Our panel today includes Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, and our very own Troy Oppie, host of All Things Considered with Boise State Public Radio. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday, Gemma.
Yes, happy to be here.
So, Clark, let's start with the debate over an open primary in Idaho. You've been on the program before talking about this, but in case folks aren't completely aware, can you briefly explain what's going on and then tell us about some pretty high-profile Republicans who are actually coming out in support of this effort?
Yeah, for sure. And I'll invite Scott to join in as well, because I know Scott has covered this, and Scott was at a press conference that I was at the other day, so it was good to see him. But yeah, this is a new ballot initiative that a group called Idahoans for Open Primaries and Reclaim Idaho are gathering signatures for right now. They're hoping to have it appear on the November 2024 general election ballot. And this ballot initiative would do a couple of things if they're successful. It aims to get rid of the closed party primary that we have in the state of Idaho. And instead, it would replace the closed party primaries with a single primary election that all candidates and all voters would participate in, regardless of party affiliation. And then from that primary, the four top vote getters would then advance to the November general election. And this ballot initiative would also make changes to the November general election. It would start a new system called ranked choice instant runoff voting, where Idahoans would vote for their favorite candidate, and then they would have the opportunity to rank the other three candidates on their ballot in order of preference. So you would have a first choice, a second choice, a third choice, and a fourth choice if you would like. Or you could just pick your first choice. And then from there, when we get into the voting, the candidate with the fewest amount of votes would be eliminated. And then their votes would be transferred to the second choice candidate on each of those ballots. And that process would continue until there were two candidates left and the person with the most votes would be elected the winner. That's been going on for a couple of months. That's been in and out of the court system. There was an Idaho Supreme Court ruling on this. There was a fight over the ballot language, the ballot titles, but now they're moving forward with collecting signatures, with holding events all across the state of Idaho. They have a May goal to gather signatures from 6% of voters statewide and 6% of voters in 18 of the state's 35 legislative districts. And then this week, there was a big announcement on Wednesday where former Governor Butch Otter and former First Lady Lori Otter came out and endorsed the open primary initiative. They said the closed primary has resulted in changing politics in the state of Idaho, changing the Republican Party. It's ushered in extremism. It's ushered in folks who, according to the Otters, are in it to further themselves. And they said this open primary initiative will give more people a voice in shaping who our candidates are going to be. They're saying with the closed primaries, a very, very small percentage of voters are deciding who wins. And as we know in Idaho, the Republican primary is the big dance. And so they're saying it would open it up. More people, independents would be able to participate. Anybody would be able to participate regardless of party affiliation. And that's the latest. And I'll let Scott step in or see if you have any questions, Gemma.
Well, Scott, I'm just curious about your thoughts on this as even more and more high-profile Republicans start backing this effort.
Yeah, a couple of observations. As Clark detailed very succinctly and well, this is not just opening up the primary. So like he said, currently the Republican primary is closed to only Republican registered voters. This would do much more than just say, okay, now unaffiliated voters and Democrats could vote in the Republican primary. This would open up the primary completely so that everyone would vote in the primary. And then it also includes the ranked choice voting. And it was interesting, one of the reporters, I think it was Joe Paris from KTVB, asked the governor, Governor Otter, how he felt about the ranked choice voting portion of it. And, you know, he said, well, I really haven't looked into it too much, and, you know, kind of gave a non-answer. And so, you know, our editorial board is holding off on endorsing the Open Primaries Initiative because I think there still needs to be a lot more debate and examination of exactly what this would do, that this is not just opening up the Republican primary to unaffiliated voters who are disenfranchised in the current system. It goes well beyond that and radically changes how we elect candidates. And now, again, the so-called moderate or traditional Republicans in the party are decrying the fact that the extremists have taken over the party. Well, they put in the work and they've gone to the meetings and they've run for precinct committee positions and they have won seats to the county central committees and the state central committee and made the rules. And so I asked Governor Otter and Lori Otter, you know, why not just take the party back and open the primary back up again? And you know, they said that there wasn't a new guard that has stepped up to do that work. And so really this Open Primaries Initiative, where there's 116 Republicans apparently who are in favor of it, is really seeking to solve a problem within the Idaho Republican Party. And I think our editorial board said, yes, go ahead and get this, sign the petition, get it on the ballot. Let's have a deeper discussion. But there certainly are other solutions to this other than radically changing our election system. Mm-hmm.
Well, with that said, Scott, I mean, but could the argument be made that in some ways, maybe it's giving all parties more of a voice? And what I mean by that is almost always a Republican wins a major statewide election in Idaho. And if there is ranked choice voting, the likelihood is if there are four people on the ballot, at least three of them are going to be Republicans. So does it give everyone, no matter what political party, more of a choice of who would potentially win versus here's the Republican, here's the Democrat. We all know the Republican's going to win.
That is certainly an argument that is being made. I think the question is whether we need to alter the elections that much to have the outcome of a fairer system rather than have it just be the exclusive purview of the Republican Party primary. Do we need to make that much of a radical change to the election system?
So, Troy, let me bring you into the conversation, because earlier this week, you reported on the Ada County Commissioners meeting. They were discussing whether or not to put a jail bond, jail expansion bond on the ballot. Where are we with this? Because this is a significant amount of money.
It is. And they have approved putting that to voters this November. The bond that they're going to put forth is for $49 million. And it's over a 20-year period, which means the interest is going to boost it. The final cost over that 20-year period to almost to approximately $71.6 million. Some of that is going to or could change if they paid it off early, for example, or if something changed with interest rates between now and February when they think they'll take the bond to market if it passes in November. It wouldn't be a huge cost to homeowners of the average value property in the county that's just shy of $500,000. And so the taxable value on that for this bond would work out to just over $13 a year, between $13 and $14 a year. The county is going to chip in about $20 million of its own money. Some of that has already been spent. They've already purchased the land next to the existing jail, for example. They've done some planning as well. And so the total cost for the project itself is right about $68 million plus that $22 million or so of interest over the 20-year period of the bond. That's what's going to come before voters. The county and the Ada County Sheriff's Office are planning an education campaign to help voters understand what the need for this is. They have to be very careful. They cannot advocate for the bond officially. Mm. That's thanks to a new law that was a law that was refined, I should say, by the legislature recently. So they have to be careful and not advocate, but they can educate. And they've planned some of that to get around some of the opposition that they've seen for, you know, why do we need to expand the jail? Some of it is infrastructure related. They're still working on the original sized kitchen and the original sized warehouse, and those need to drastically change to better serve the population and the staff at the jail, they say. But the expansion would also add around 300 new beds in new dormitories that would help with some of the capacity issues in its general dorms that the jail has faced in recent years as population here has grown. But some of the opposition, too, is, are these dorms being filled up with low-level offenders, misdemeanor offenders, mm-hmm. for example? And largely, they're not. Sheriff Clifford told commissioners yesterday that just about 90% of current inmates, as data as of yesterday, are in facing felony charges. Very few inmates at the county jail are there for long-term serving of sentence. Most are awaiting trial or in progress or being held on behalf of the U.S. Marshals Service or awaiting transfer to a state prison to serve a sentence. So there are a lot of variables at play. You're going to see a lot of education work from the county towards this as we get closer to the election in November.
So, Scott, I want to talk about some reporting that the Idaho Statesman just did in regards to Senator Jim Risch wanting to reroute flights away from Southwest Boise. This has to do with what's called the Federal Aviation Administration Reauthorization Act. So let's start with what this is, because basically what? Twice a decade, Congress just approves a bill and it's basically like, you know, let's keep funding our airports and things like that. But something kind of snuck into this latest one.
Yeah. This is quite a story. And this is Kevin Fixler, Idaho Statesman reporter, did an investigation into the great lengths that Senator Risch went to try to divert flights from over his 44-acre ranch that's about a mile and a half west of the Boise Airport in Southwest Boise. Over the past 2 years, he has lobbied the city of Boise, the Boise mayor, the Boise Airport, the Boise Airport Director, even the FAA and the FAA Director, called the FAA Director directly to try to get flights diverted from over his ranch, claiming that he has received complaints about noise of the planes. And he was trying to get the planes diverted from over his house to go through Meridian and Nampa. Instead, over tens of thousands of other houses other than his ranch, over these noise complaints. And officially, the FAA rejected his requests in October. And so he, you know, went through all of these avenues to try to get the flights diverted. And the FAA officially rejected his request. Mm-hmm. Well, so Senator Risch went to his fellow Republican Senator Ted Cruz and asked him to insert this section into the reauthorization bill. And this is basically just a funding bill for the Federal Aviation Administration, and inserted in that bill at the end under miscellaneous was a plan to divert planes away from Senator Risch's ranch. And if anyone violated that, they would be guilty of a misdemeanor. So it actually had criminal liability involved mm-hmm. with that. and meanwhile, aviation experts said that this was just a terrible idea, that this would hurt safety and efficiency. It would affect thousands, if not tens of thousands, of other residents with noise, because it would be going over much populated areas of Meridian and Nampa. The aviation experts actually testified to Meridian officials. There was one email from a J.R. Williams telling the mayor of Meridian that Funneling the vast majority of louder and large aircraft over one specific point is anything but noise mitigation. It may be mitigation for Mr. Risch, as overflight over his house would become a criminal misdemeanor. Senator Risch doesn't seem to care about the folks in Meridian, Eagle Star, or Nampa. He only wants jets to stay away from his house. And now this J.R. Williams is no slouch. He is a Boise resident, but he is also a colonel in the Idaho Air National Guard. And knows what he's talking about. And so Senator Risch did actually sit down and talk with Kevin Fixler about this and told him that that it wasn't really a big deal. He was just, you know, responding to complaints that he's heard from other people. However, mm-hmm. he would not supply any of those complaints to us, would not share, even redacted. He wouldn't even, you know, share the complaints and remove people's names. Wouldn't even tell us how many complaints that he had received. And even though he said it was not a big deal, the records show that he spent 2 years, the better part of 2 years, complaining and sending emails to public officials. And like I said, calling the FAA director directly in a 30-minute phone call, trying to lobby his position. And then, of course, trying to get this unusual step, very unusual step, to get the flight pattern changed in this reauthorization bill. Usually changing flight patterns like this, and keep in mind too, that these are flights that are commercial and military. So of course we've got Gowan mm-hmm. Field over there with the Idaho Air National Guard. This would have affected military planes as well. And usually to do this, it requires a very lengthy FAA process where you're looking at environmental impacts, the noise impacts of the proposed flight paths. And this would have skirted all of that. Senator Risch did tell us that he did remove the language from the bill after he started getting pushback from some residents. And the language is still in the bill. And Kevin Fixler told me that that the language will get removed in markups of the bill later, but it's still in there for now. And we wrote an editorial about this mm-hmm. Following the story after the story came out, basically saying this is a really egregious case of abuse of power, use of the privilege and position of your power that you and I don't have access to. You know, we maybe could call up the Boise mayor and get a phone call and complain. Possibly you could call the Boise airport director and have a conversation with her, maybe. But I would really seriously doubt you'd be able to call up the FAA director and have a 30-minute conversation about noise of airplanes over your house. And then I'm really pretty almost positive that you would not be able to, however popular you are, Gemma, you probably would not be able to saunter over to Senator Ted Cruz's office and get a language inserted into a twice decade language of a federal Congress, act of Congress, to divert planes from over your house. And really the paper trail shows that this was just a concerted effort to personally benefit Senator Risch.
Well, and Scott, that was the thing that really stuck out to me in Kevin's reporting. And folks, you should go read this. It's a pretty in-depth article. Because I believe that Kevin actually also spoke to the then acting FAA director, right? And he basically said that Senator Risch could not give him any examples of noise complaints. And in fact, then let's talk about talking with the airport director, which Kevin did, Rebecca Hupp. And she said that they take noise complaints, within about a 3-mile radius of right. the airport. Everything else has to go to the FAA. And over the last 2 years, they had 18 complaints.
And none of them were in that area of Southwest Boise. Right. And so it's clear if there is evidence of other people complaining, there is no evidence of anyone other than Senator Risch complaining over these noise complaints. If there is evidence, certainly Senator Risch did not provide those complaints to us. Or even provide the number of complaints that he's received. That for the record, there's the only complaints that are on record are from Senator Risch himself.
So to be very clear, Scott, this wording will be taken out of this this congressional bill. So nothing will change. I mean, flight patterns will not be rerouted.
That is correct. That is what we've been told. And apparently there is some communication where Senator Risch has told not just us, but other people that he is removing the language from the bill. It is not yet removed from the language of the bill. But like I said, Kevin told me before the show that when the bill is marked up, then the language will be removed. But I know Kevin will be looking very carefully at all those markups to see if and when that language is indeed removed, in which case it's the status quo. Nothing will change.
Okay. So, Troy, we've been hearing rumblings for quite a few months now about a possible merger between Albertsons and Kroger. Are we closer to this happening? And what do we know? Anything new coming out of this?
By the calendar estimate, yes, we are closer. They have forecast this to happen early next year. We don't know exactly where in the process regulatory review is, but the announcement, this actually happened late last week. It was first reported by Reuters, possibly Bloomberg. I'm not sure who had it first. And then Albertsons confirmed with a public release late on Friday. And that is that they have entered into a deal, Albertsons and Kroger entered into a deal to sell off more than 400 of the combined company stores to a third party. C&S Suppliers is this company, and they are more of a supplier than a grocer. They own a couple dozen retail grocery stores, mostly in the Midwest. Folks might recognize the Piggly Wiggly name brand. C&S owns those stores and a few others. This would dramatically change their retail grocery footprint, of course. We don't know, though, exactly which stores Albertsons and Kroger have decided to sell. There are 13 that were identified in the state of Idaho. That's about half of the retail locations now. Washington State, for example, had more than 100 stores that would be sold off as part of the deal, including brands like QFC. That, for me, that's a legacy grocery store brand up in the Pacific Northwest that I grew up going to occasionally. So there's some big changes in the Pacific Northwest and in the Mountain West for these chains, where you do have a lot of stores in very close proximity to each other, and regulatory officials are going to take a pretty dim view of that in terms of what that does to market competition. So if you're looking for an example, and again, we don't know what stores were identified here, but the example for me is actually close to my house, that corner at 5 Mile and Overland, where you have an Albertsons on one corner and a Fred Meyer on the other corner. Fred Meyer's owned by Kroger. Mm-hmm. Those would be the situations where you're likely ripe to see at least one of those locations sold off. The deal is for about $2 billion, and more stores could be added to it. The two companies have previously said they would be willing to sell up to 650 of their combined about 5,000 locations to make this deal happen. So there may be more stores sold off to C&S, which again is going to greatly expand its retail grocery footprint. They've picked up some administrative office space in this, some supply warehouses, distribution warehouses as well across the country. We don't know where any of those are yet, but it appears that that deal is moving forward and could be on schedule for, again, what that expectation is to close early next year.
So, Clark, you have been on our program before. We've talked about potentially going back into a special session, our legislators. So where are we in this process? Because my understanding is that it would address the presidential primary election that Republicans basically inadvertently got rid of.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I'll let you and Scott jump in as well. We're kind of at the will they, won't they stage of the special session negotiations. The legislature has the new power to call itself back into session if 60% of the members of both the Idaho Senate and the Idaho House sign a petition to come back into session. So far, the Idaho Senate has that support, but the proposal has run into resistance in the Idaho House. But yeah, it all goes back to the issue of the presidential primary election. This is just the presidential primary election. And Gemma, you're absolutely right. The Idaho legislature seemingly, unknowingly, unintentionally eliminated the presidential primary election this year. There was a bill earlier in the session, I think it was House Bill 138, And it was advertised as a way to save the state about $2.7 million every 4 years by taking our presidential primary election and moving it back from where it had been in March and instead putting it in May when the rest of the state's primary elections take place. Mm-hmm. But what happened is the bill didn't actually move the presidential primary. It just eliminated it. And so there's been kind of this whole mess since the legislative session adjourned in early April about whether and how the state is going to deal with this. And so there's disagreements, and some of the sticking points are the two dates, the March date versus the May date. And then we have this caucus versus presidential primary discussion going on as well. So there's kind of a couple of sticking points. But as things stand right now, I spoke with Representative Brent Crane, the chairman of the House State Affairs Committee, which is where the first bill went through. This is where this new bill would have to go. He says the proposal from the Senate, which is really focused on the May date, that doesn't have the votes to advance in the House. And so him and Speaker of the House, Mike Moyle, told me yesterday that there is not agreement at this time to sign on to the Senate's plan, which is all about following through and moving that presidential primary election to May, to actually moving it. So no agreement in the House right now, but there's kind of a deadline floating out there of October 1st. The Idaho Republican Party this summer had said, we're going to go ahead and have a caucus if the legislature does not reinstate the presidential primary election specifically to March. We're going to go ahead and have a caucus in March. And the caucus is dividing the party. A caucus is a lengthy mm-hmm. process that Idaho has gone through in 2012.
And Clark.
And not well, right. It's a lengthy process. You have to go in person. There were news reports out at the time where people waited hours outside just to get into the caucus, let alone even get inside and to participate. And so some legislators are saying, we want to fix this. We want to go back to the presidential primary. But there's disagreement on whether to do it in March and May, in March or in May, excuse me, rather. And so right now we've got this October 1st deadline, which is coming up just about 2 weeks away. And so we're at the negotiation stage. No agreement yet. But interestingly, Representatives Crane and Moyle told me that actually this week there's some movement in the House to support a March primary, which is what they thought they were repealing. And so it's up in the air, no agreement yet. This would be the first time that the legislature calls itself back into session if it happens. And previously, only Idaho's governor had the ability to call a special session. We have checked in with the governor. It's been a little bit of a while, but the governor said, this is an issue for the legislature, and if they want to address it, they can call themselves back into session. And so it's kind of the will they, won't they phase, and we're getting close to running up against that deadline. So I think we'll find out in the next week or so if we're going to do it or not. But no agreement right now. But I know Scott has written about this, and Scott has looked at the debate between the two dates, March and May. And so I think I'll let Scott step in and kind of talk about the significance of the dates and what the argument is there.
Yeah, and here's why voters should be outraged, particularly with Mike Moyle and Brent Crane saying there's not votes for it and they want to change it to March. They already voted on this. Clark referenced this earlier, House Bill 138. That's the bill that moved the primary date from March to May, under the very conservative, fiscally conservative notion of saving $2.7 million, election consolidation. They did that for the school districts. They got rid of the March election for them. And so it makes sense. That bill passed 61-6 in the House, and it passed 23-11 in the Senate. They've already decided on this. Two of the people who voted in favor of that bill, Brent Crane and Mike Moyle, and now they're saying they want to go back to March. And in fact, they caught their mistake during the last session. They realized very late in the session, oh, shoot, we passed this House Bill 138 to move the primary to May, but we messed up the language and we need to get the presidential primary back in there. And so they had a trailer bill that got shot down at the last minute, primarily under the lobbying of Idaho Republican Party Chairwoman Dorothy Moon, who railed against it, saying, no, we want to have it in March. And so this whole mess is because they're going back on what they already voted on. And some would say that trying to do this March caucus is actually a way to indeed limit who can vote in the caucus. And for sure, the caucus would limit who participates and might actually, you know, consolidate again, control in the hands of a very small number of people in the Idaho Republican Party.
So, Scott, I find that interesting that they did catch this mistake, because as Clark and you were both talking, I was sitting here thinking, so was this just someone not reading the fine print? And that's why they're in this predicament. But that's not the case.
Well, it is the case on the original bill. They did mess up. And when they voted on it, they were still voting on the concept of moving the primary to May. And so they all knew that that's what they were doing, and they were doing it. The statement of purpose is very clear. The presidential primary is going to cost us $2.7 million. Next time this comes around, we're going to have even more people. And, you know, it's very clear that this was the intent of the bill. They just screwed up on the language of it and inadvertently left out the presidential primary in it. Mm-hmm. And then when they tried to fix it, then they went back and said, oh, no, we want to do this in March. And now apparently Speaker Moyle and Representative Crane are going back on their word and back on their vote to change it to May. And now they want to do it in March, which, again, it's a creation of a mess of their own doing.
Mm-hmm. And Clark, you know, with all of this going on, I mean, it's not like Idaho necessarily sees a lot of presidential candidates, you know, campaigning, but we have that happen. It's not unheard of. But I was just going to say, Clark, really quickly, I would assume, though, that this could potentially make no candidates want to come here.
Well, it's interesting, and it is about influence, and that gets into it. But the first things first, Gemma, you're right. Idaho is a small state based on population. And so we have a small number of electoral votes in the general election, and we have a small mm-hmm. number of delegates for the primary election, which is what we're talking about. So the idea is that, yes, the people who support the March date say we want to be up early in the calendar. We want to be close to that Super Tuesday where there's all this national attention around the primary. But at the end of the day, Idaho has a very small share of delegates and will have a small influence mm-hmm. in the race. And so that's one thing to consider. The other thing with the May date, though, I had done some reporting when this bill first came up, and the May date is late. It's late in May. And so before Idaho made the change to March, Idaho was actually doing it in May. And five different presidential candidates had already clinched the nomination before mm-hmm. Idahoans even voted in May, because it was so late in the process. And so you run into a situation where, like in 2008, the nomination had already been sewn up. John McCain, the late senator from Arizona, had already clinched the Republican primary nomination before Idahoans even got to vote. That's happened five other times. Bob Dole, George Bush, McCain, and then Democrats Al Gore and John Kerry had also already clinched their nominations before this May date would have come up. And so Idaho has a small number of delegates. Idaho is not likely to play a large role in this race, but it's a discussion that's going to ultimately affect potentially how hundreds of thousands of people are able to vote in these presidential nominating contests in Idaho. So it's an important discussion. It's an absolute mess. It's a mess that the legislature and the state government kind of created and then have not addressed so far. But yeah, it's sticking points between March and May, but recognizing that Idaho is a very small state with very few delegates in play. And so those are mm-hmm. some of the discussion points, but it's about politics. It's about influence. And that's kind of where we're at right now. Will they, won't they, in terms of fixing their mess, in terms of having a special session going forward with a caucus that it seems like people have bad memories of from 2012. And so it is a big old mess. And it's frustrating, and it's kind of an insidery thing to talk about. But at the end of the day, it is going to affect how potentially hundreds of thousands of people are able to vote in the presidential nominating caucus. This process, this is just like 6 months away. And mm-hmm. so it's coming to a head one way or the other.
Yeah, it's important no matter what. Well, I want to thank all of you for coming in and talking with us today. Really appreciate your time. Our Friday Reporter Roundtable, our panelists today, Clark Corbin with the Idaho Capital Sun, Scott McIntosh, opinion editor with the Idaho Statesman, and our very own Troy Oppie, host of All Things Considered with Boise State Public Radio News. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, we're taking center stage. Introducing NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, a collection of Black-led stories from NPR's podcasts. Search NPR Black Stories, Black Truths wherever you get your podcasts.